It was almost real. The Pro Wrestling History Podcast, episode 63. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to the history of professional wrestling from 1870 to 1930. And joining me on this week's show is my sons, Trey and Caleb, who are back in studio. And before I give an update, we were just discussing, we wanted to get this done so we could watch Svengoolie. And then I looked up what was on Svengoolie this week, and it is Killer Clowns from Outer Space. So there's no need for us to rush and get done with this podcast anytime soon. And one of the things I always thought was hilarious is my daughter is terrified of clowns. So this would be the worst movie in the world for her to watch. And I always said, somebody comes at me with those big old clown shoes, you just step on their toes and just dribble them like a speed bag. Yeah. Are you too scared of clowns?
No.
No.
Why would I ever be scared of a man in makeup?
Yeah, with big old shoes and a red nose.
No. Probably not.
Now, if I ever run into a clown, it's going to be like the meeting of when somebody who pretends to be insane meets someone, or when someone who pretends to be insane meets somebody who pretends to be sane.
Very nice, very nice. I mean, it is a cult classic, but I mean, if you didn't watch it originally or you didn't like it originally, you're going to hate it.
I do find it weird that after all these years, they suddenly decide to make a lopsided, like, Dead by Daylight video game out of it.
Oh, I'm not. Our regional manager was talking about it, so.
Interesting.
They made a video game out of that movie?
They sure did.
Years later, literally, like, just recently, they're making a, there's a genre of horror game called lopsided horror, or, like, I don't remember what the technical term for it, but it's basically like four on, like, one person plays as the monster and then everybody else plays as the survivors, and each team has their own objective. And
beat up Bozo?
Survive.
Usually just survive and escape.
The only clown I ever had any use for was Homie the Clown from In Living Color in the 1990s.
Homie the Clown don't play like that.
Yeah, Homie don't play that. Yeah, if you don't know what we're talking about, look it up on YouTube. I know they've got all those skits up there from the In Living Color TV show. But yeah, that was the only clown I ever had any use for.
I can see why.
So the update this week is kind of brief. Shooter in a Worked World, John Pesek in the 1920s Promotional Wars should be out on Amazon by the time you hear this. And the audiobook will be available in about a week or two. It normally takes a week or two after those three publish to be able to publish the audiobook. And I already kind of know what I'm going to do for my next project, which I'll talk about actually in the main content for today. But something I want to run by you two. Your uncle would really like us to go to a weekly podcast. And since he's going to be returning in the next week or two, we've been talking about the feasibility of doing that. I'm not necessarily against a weekly show, but as I've told you guys before, I don't want it to be a weekly weekly offering. I want it to be, you know, something that people find worth listening to. One of the things I've been thinking about is if we would go to a week, every week format, we're probably going to have to change how the show goes. So right now we do the update, we do the main history content, and we do reviews. And we may review modern stuff, we may review really old stuff. Normally we review a lot of really old stuff. But I think that would have to change a little bit, and maybe sometimes all we do is a review. So your uncle and I have reviewed 350 Days, which is a documentary about professional wrestling during the territory era. And we've also done, we're going to do a review of Iron Claw, the movie about the Von Erichs. but since you two are on the show often, what do you think about weekly? We've done twice a month, and then this year, except when I was super busy at work, we were doing every week except for the third week. That's when I would put out a blog post.
I know.
So if you switch to weekly, I assume we're on bi-weekly. I haven't been keeping up too much.
Kind of. Well,
everyone.
In all reality.
On podcast with your pop-up, buddy.
We've almost been weekly, except for that third week, for most of this year. But originally we were bi-weekly. Oh, has Connor joined us?
Yeah, he just opened up my door. He's just chilling out for a second.
Hey, buddy.
You're okay, sweetie. I heard someone messing with the door, and then a foot went under the door, so I knew who it was. Opened it before he hurt himself.
So you never know what's going to happen on the podcast, folks. We have been bombarded, or we've had a youngster of four break into the podcast.
Almost four.
Soon to be four. Yep, next month.
I love how you almost went into the WKRP bombarded with live turkeys there.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll see you once we're done, okay?
What was the name of that mall? The something mall has just been bombed by live turkeys.
Yeah. So the only thing I was going to warn you about is, depending on how frequently you're already doing it, which I assume is bi-weekly at this point.
Yeah, we'll just call it bi-weekly because that's more often than not the format that it's, or I'm sorry, that's more often than not the schedule that it has been.
Well, I feel like that would be a decent rate of flow while also giving us time to, like, come up with actual substance.
I don't think that's too hard with bi-weekly because now you're just doubling your workload.
And if we really want to do, like, a special thing, we could do, like, one on, like, just drop one in a week that we don't normally post, so.
Yeah.
So you two don't think we should go to a weekly schedule?
I'm just saying, like, I was trying to do, and YouTube videos are a little bit more, like, you don't have to research as much or do anything other stuff, but I could not keep up with trying to do daily videos on that.
I would never do daily. I'm talking about
what I'm saying is like when you're producing content, you do need to like be extremely careful about what all you can actually feasibly do with the amount of time and other commitments because you also have your nephews, you got Taekwondo and everything else. So,
well, and I've got a very busy work life right now as well.
Right. And that's the thing. Danny can say that, but he works, he's self-employed. He does his eBay stuff and everything.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, I also get where he's coming from, where, you know, like Dad said, we're actually getting more viewers since we're on YouTube now, so it would make sense to put out more.
I didn't announce that. We are finally on YouTube now, and we've got about 49 of the 62 episodes up, which that's also something. So we actually have 64 episodes. Because your uncle and I did bonus episodes in 2023, and we made those half episodes. So like 38.5, 39.5. I'm not going to go back and relabel those and that because wherever they've been shared, it'll screw up the track back if people want to listen to that.
Right.
But so I think what I'm going to do, though, to get us back on track, and I'll never do half episodes again. I didn't think this through when I did it the first time. Is I'm just going to skip two episodes at some point. So let's say we go to 64 and then I just skip to 67. And I'll make sure I put notes in there that says, no, that there, you're not mishearing this. We did two bonus episodes that were 0.5, so we're skipping 65 and 66 or whichever two episodes I decide to skip. I do want to get us back on that. So, in actuality, we've got 51 of the 64 episodes up right now. This is, even though this is episode 63, it's actually the 65th podcast we've done.
Okay.
Because it's going to be hardest for me because I've got to come up with the history content each time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons I was thinking maybe we'll just change the format to where we just do one of the weeks is just a straight review week, whether we review a documentary, The Iron Claw. I just put something up about Shadow of the Thin Man, which is a movie from the early 1940s. And the Swedish, they have a wrestling scene there, and the Swedish Angel is in it. And it's the only picture of Tor Johnson I've ever, not picture, he was in wrestling in the movie. But it's the only time I've seen Tor Johnson, the Swedish Angel, with hair.
Interesting.
He was normally bald. You guys saw him. He was the big guy in Bride of the Monster, those horrible movies I made you guys watch while you were in high school.
I remember.
Yeah, I probably blacked that out of my memory.
So, more to come. We may go to a weekly schedule. I'm still mulling that around in my head. As I said, I don't want to just be throwing junk up to, you know, have an episode out every week. I want it to be worth listening to.
Which is fair.
So. Which is honestly what's going to end up, like, A. Because that's kind of like part of the reason I think yours is standing out right now is anybody can do a podcast, but not everybody can do a podcast right.
And
there's so many lazy podcasts right now where it's just like, oh, hey, we're going to go just do X, talk about X, Y, and Z. And it's just them having conversations of things that people normally already like kind of think about and talk about anyway.
Well, this is the most neglected time period in pro wrestling history. And as I discover every time I take on a new project, so much of what we thought we knew is not really correct, which is one of the things I'm going to talk about in today's content. Each time I do a project, I'm realizing that a lot of the commonly held beliefs about this era were not correct. A lot of it because it comes from the Fall Guys that Marcus Griffith wrote. And some of the stuff he wrote about was, you know, 10, 20 years before he was in the Buffalo Wrestling Office. So he's hearing stories from the wrestlers. And those stories are often, because wrestlers are storytellers, they have exaggerated things. They've left things out to make the story better. But it also has given us a false history of what actually happened back then. And I like the Fall Guys. It's a great source to start your research, but you never want to just take something that's written in that book and repeat it like it's gospel without doing the research, because so much of that I found, some of it outright false, but a lot of it is just part of the story. Mm-hmm. So it's wrong by omission as opposed to being wrong by commission.
Right.
And I wanted to make a recommendation before I jump into the history content. So both of you, having watched MMA when you were kids, their UFC Fight Pass has put up a bunch of their documentaries on YouTube recently, which I have to say are pretty good. And I was asked my opinion at one of the football drafts of who I thought the greatest mixed martial artist of all time was. And my opinion actually hasn't changed since then, even with all of the MMA fighters that have come since. In my mind, the GOAT, the greatest of all time, is still Anderson Silva, who was the UFC middleweight champion from 2006 to 2013. And he not only cleaned out the middleweight division, he would pop up to 205 and fight like heavyweights and knock them out too.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's one person who I think could challenge Anderson for greatest of all time and is probably more skilled, but the repeated failures of the drug test and being stripped of the light heavyweight title, and now over the last 4 or 5 years being very inactive and cherry picking his opponents, John Bones Jones should have been the greatest of all time. But because he's his own worst enemy and because he got into all kinds of trouble outside of the ring at different times, he failed a bunch of drug tests and had his title stripped, Anderson to me is still the GOAT because he dominated for that 7 years. The only complaint people had about Anderson is sometimes his fights were boring because he would fight grapplers like Talos Latus, who would constantly be dropping to the floor because they didn't want to stand with Anderson. Mm. And if you watch this documentary, you'll understand why nobody wants to stand with Anderson, because he was a amazing striker. But the name of the documentary, and I will put it in the show notes at kenzermanjr.com/episode63. It's called The Baddest Man on the Planet, The Anderson Silva Story. And it's, I believe UFC Fight Pass is who uploaded it to YouTube. Mm. But I highly recommend it. I think you two would like it a lot. Okay. And I would have reviewed it, but I've got a couple wrestling pay-per-views and premium live events that happened over the last couple weeks that I figured we'd talk about in the review section and knock those out. But Anderson fought a guy named Chael Sonnen, and it was the only fight he almost lost. Sonnen just used his wrestling to keep taking him down, and that was Anderson's only weak point. He had amazing jiu-jitsu, amazing Muay Thai, but he was in Brazil and they didn't have a lot of competitive wrestling, so he had not wrestled. And so the one style that could give him trouble, and he knocked out a lot of wrestlers, but Sonnen was a very, very good amateur wrestler, and he kept taking Anderson down. And he outstruck Anderson like 311-11. But as Sonnen said, all 11 of those strikes from Anderson hurt and did damage. Anderson hit him with two elbows from the bottom. Both of those elbows cut Sonnen's eyes. And Anderson, other than an injured rib, didn't look like he had been in a fight after he got done. And Chael was all cut up and his leg was all beat up and he'd only been hit 11 times.
Right.
It's well worth the watch, and it's a short documentary. It's probably 25, 30 minutes.
Okay.
So, the history concept. Somebody doing construction?
No, that's my chair moving. I'm sorry.
Oh. I thought you were putting up a shelf over there. It's like,
afraid
man,
not, no.
He's got bored with me already.
No.
The main content for this week is actually what my next research project is going to be on. And I got the idea for doing this while I was researching the Pesek book. So Pesek, in 1926, double-crossed Joe Stecker in the third match they had that year. They had already wrestled two works, and Stecker trusted Pesek, so he let Pesek put him in a double arm wrist lock. You guys probably know it as the Kimura from MMA.
Yeah.
And Stecker cranked on it. And, or not Stecker, Pesek cranked on it, and Stecker had to give up. And Stecker was already leery, at least that's all the story has always been. He was always leery that his partners. So let's go back a year before Pesek double-crosses Stecker. Stecker was involved in the most famous double-cross in professional wrestling history. He did not execute the double-cross, but he was one of the people that paid Stanislaw Sobieski to double-cross Big Wayne Munn in 1925. Munn was a football player, pure performer, did not know how to wrestle. Lewis and Mott had told Billy Sandow, because they were all in a promotion together, that's in history, it's known as the Gold Dust Trio, but it was Sandow, the promoter manager, Ed Strangler Lewis, the world champion, and Mott, Lewis's training partner, but he was also a promotional genius. And a lot of the ideas and the speeded up wrestling are all from Mott and Mott's promotional genius. Mott and Lewis tell Sandow not to put the belt on Munn because Munn is a pure performer. If any just a mediocre wrestler were to shoot on Munn, Munn would lose. Mm-hmm. And Sandow said, don't worry about it. I'll only put him with people we trust. And he trusted Stanislaw Sobieski. But Zabisco's brother Vladek had been frozen out by the Sandow promotion from wrestling for the World Championship. And unbeknownst to them, Stanislaus Obispo wasn't real happy about that. And when they approached him with the money to double-cross Munn, he did it. Mm-hmm. Well, that led to a divided championship for 3 years because Sandow had an in with several of the athletic commissions, so Michigan and Illinois did not recognize Zabisco's defeat of Munn in Philadelphia. Most of the other athletic commissions did. So Stecker and Zabisco had a worked title match in St. Louis on May 30th, a month after Zabisco double-crosses Munn. Mm. And Stecker wins that title. But Munn still has the Michigan and Illinois titles because Michigan and Illinois will not recognize Zabisco's win. So on May 30th in Michigan, Ed Strangler Lewis defeats Munn for the world title. So you have a divided world championship for 3 years. And the common held belief about this, and it was in the Fall Guys, was basically Ed Strangler Lewis defended the world championship like he was still the world champion. And Stecker, because he was so fearful of a double cross from his partners, because Paul Bowser and Jack Curley and several others were involved in this shenanigans, he virtually retired the belt. Well, he did, after Stecker double-crossed him, he was inactive for 6 weeks. But he came back and wrestled 6 weeks later. And not only did he and Lewis both defend those championships frequently, Stecker had 25 title defenses in 1927. They had a legitimate contest in St. Louis in February 1928 to reunify the titles, basically, to have one world champion. But during that three-year period, I've discovered that Stecker was at least as active as Lewis was, and he was wrestling legitimate wrestlers both before and after he wrestled Joe Stecker. So there was truth to the fact that he was nervous about a double cross with certain people because he walked out of the ring in Boston when Bowser tried to substitute Joe Malkiewicz, who was a shooter and a hooker on Stecker's level, with the schlub that he thought he was going to be wrestling. He thought he was going to be wrestling a local guy that Bowser was behind that he could defeat easily if he tried to double cross him, but then Bowser tries to put Malkiewicz in the ring with him, and Stecker didn't trust Malkiewicz not to double cross him. And when you're doing a work match and you fear somebody's going to double cross you, it's really dangerous, because as he found when he trusted Stecker, if you give someone your body and let them put a submission on you and then they double cross you, you can't get out of it, you're stuck. But the way that both of those guys have been portrayed is not accurate. And I found so far, I've only been researching for about a month, not only did they both defend the titles frequently, they often were wrestling in the same towns at times. So when they were in a certain area and they were wrestling, Stecker might be the world champion in one area recognized, whereas in another area, Lewis might be the recognized world champion. And some promoters who had previously been aligned with the other one. So the Wichita promoter got started with the help of Billy Sandow. But when Stecker did the double cross with Zabisco and then took the title from Zabisco in the work match, the Wichita promoter decided to start booking Stecker as his world champion. And it ended his relationship with Sandow's promotion, even though Sandow's promotion helped him to get started. And others chose to book, you know, Lewis. And then some, like Los Angeles, Lou Darrow was powerful enough, he booked both guys.
Mm. Interesting.
The one thing that I think is probably true is the divided championship confused the fans, and it did hurt the box office. That kind of stuff often did. Mm. But I can't say that definitively right now. But there has to be some impetus for why they finally decided to reunite the titles in 1928. it was almost 3 years after the Double Cross. The Double Cross happened in April 15th in Philadelphia. They switched the titles, Munn to Lewis and Zbyszko to Stecher, on May 30th, 1925. And then from May 30th, 1925 until February 1928, Stecher and Lewis both defended the titles. But I've got to imagine it did confuse fans, and it probably did hurt them at the box office. Otherwise, I can't see why either one of them would agree to a contest to settle it. And before the title was divided, it was a license to print money. Ed Strangler Lewis was the highest paid athlete in the 1920s, with the exception of Jack Dempsey. Jack Dempsey was heavyweight boxing champion. He did make a little bit more than Lewis, but Lewis was number two, ahead of Babe Ruth, ahead of any other sports stars. It was Dempsey and Lewis were the two highest paid athletes in the 1920s. But that's where my next project's going to be. And my guess is it'll be done sometime late winter, early spring next year.
Okay.
Maybe I could get it out in the fall, but I kind of doubt it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, at least you got the latest book done. I mean, you're at least getting books out.
Yeah, I've done three this year, but one was the St. Louis history book that was already kind of written. I think two a year is probably the max that I'll be able to do. I'd love to do three. I just don't know if it's in the cards or not.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of research that goes into it, because I want the stuff that I'm writing to be accurate. So that takes a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Right. What I learned my lesson on the last couple of books was I would repeat things that I hadn't researched yet, but that were commonly held beliefs, like Stecher virtually retired the championship after he beat Zbyszko. And I'm learning that I shouldn't repeat those things if I haven't researched them myself, because a lot of the time it's not true.
Right.
So you want to talk a little modern wrestling?
Sure. What's up?
Well, no, there's the WWE under Paul Levesque has doubled its profits. And it doesn't surprise me, because the shows, since he's taken over, have been much better. And let's start with AEW and then we'll go to WWE. I think a lot of people, particularly when they listen to me and Dan start to take the piss out of AEW, think that we don't like AEW. But actually, I would like to see them truly become the number two national company, because it always benefits the wrestlers if they've got other places to work. They just don't have to work for WWE. Because, yeah, it's great under Paul Levesque right now, but if he wasn't there, would it be that great? Because under Vince, initially, early on, Vince knew what he was doing, and he wasn't crazy. And he made a lot of stars, and he made a lot of people very wealthy. Always a weird guy. He was weird from the very beginning, but he kind of lost it those last 10 years. And if I was a wrestler, I wouldn't have wanted to have my career, you know, in his hands. But he was the only game in town for a while. So unless you've got a strong number two company that could be an actual place for the wrestlers to go, they're kind of hamstrung to be stuck in a place that they're miserable doing stupid stuff, which the stuff Vince was doing over the last 10 years was stupid.
Right.
So having a viable number two company would be helpful. But it's going to have to be managed a whole heck of a lot better. So they just recently had their second Wembley card. The one last year did 70,000 paid fans. This year it was 50,000, but that's still a huge crowd. That's still a heck of an accomplishment. You know, and Tony deserves kudos for that. And the pay-per-view this time sold almost 170,000 buys, which is about 70,000 more than they have been doing recently. They've been around the $100,000 or 100,000 buy you're making a lot more than $100,000, but 100,000 buys. But you're like, they also have to rent the building, and Wembley Stadium is not going to be cheap. And they have to pay the talent. And this is one of my issues with Tony's management. He had 62, and I might have missed an odd manager somewhere for that, but the best I can tell, the buy-in show and his main card, which was about 12 or 13 matches, way too many. And Caleb's doing construction again.
I lean back.
We got to get you some WD-40. That chair is noisy.
Oh, it was broken when I got it, but I'm making it work. Don't worry.
And so 62 people on this show. And you still got to pay for the building. And to pay 62 talent is ridiculous. And the pay-per-view, probably 5 or 6 hours long. If you put the buy-in show with it, maybe 6. And your uncle and I actually really wanted to go to the AEW show in St. Louis in January because we really felt like we couldn't properly rate it until we'd been to an actual show, see what the atmosphere is like, how people react and everything. But it was like 7 hours long. We're not going to sit through seven. We're not going to sit through more than 3. You know, so if we did go, we had to leave early, you know. It just, it's not in the cards when they're that long. And WWE was doing that too. Way too long a show. But they're making money hand over fist. And the event they put on the following weekend, they had 17 wrestlers on the card. 5 matches. It went 3 hours. So that's given plenty of time for the packages in between. That's why I said you don't have to watch the wrestling show anymore to watch the premium live event, because they have such great packages. You know exactly what's been going on, why these people are mad at each other, and why they're having the match. And that's all improved tremendously under Triple H, Paul Levesque.
Who would have thunk it?
I did. I was hoping Vince would retire sooner because I thought he would do very good based on what he did with NXT. But we'll talk about NXT in a minute. So Tony has the pay-per-view. It's fairly successful, but it's 14 matches long, which is way too many matches. And he's got way too many people on these shows. Paying 62 people for that is ridiculous. Probably right. He could have got by with 20-25. Maybe 30.
Right.
If put on 7 good matches that people want to see. 1 good match on the buy-in show to get people to buy in. Maybe put a Buddy Matthews against somebody that's a credible challenger for him. And then you have the show where you have a couple tag team matches, a couple single matches that people actually care about. And I think he could actually start building this company that would be profitable. Because he's bringing in money, but it's going out quicker than he's bringing it in. And he's got this TV rights deal coming up, which that's great, and it's supposed to be lucrative. But if you keep blowing all this money, bringing these people in that nobody cares about, it's not drawing you a house, it's not making you any money, that's not how businesses thrive. And he needs to learn how to manage his company. Right now, the way he's doing it, it's a vanity project, and he's just spending his inheritance. He could make a profitable company and build on the money that his dad has given him instead of just going through it very quickly.
Well, that's typically what happens, I suppose, with trust fund babies.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But overall, the show did better. And one more point about AEW, and then we can move on to WWE. I didn't remember this, but Jim Cornette just put out one of their omnibuses. And all of it is just going through the AEW rankings, because they normally do that every week. So it's going through the ratings every week. And they started doing that in about 2021. And in 2021... they were regularly having a million people watch their television show every week. You know, they lose fans during the show, but it wasn't as pronounced as it is today. And they were starting with a much higher number. They were over a million fans almost every Wednesday. Now, they're almost never over 900,000 fans, and they're still losing big chunks of their audience. They've had a couple of weeks where they finished with, you know, 584,000 fans and, you know, started at 7-something. That's, they're going the wrong way. They keep losing audience. They're not gaining audience. Tony needs to right the ship a little bit. Right. WWE. So let's talk about what's going right, and then we can talk about what's going wrong. So their premium live events are much better. And even under Vince, the premium live events or the pay-per-views were the only thing worth watching under Vince, because the TV shows had too much juvenile comedy, the stupid stuff that Vince likes, and it was pretty much unwatchable during Vince's, you know, last 6, 7, 10 years. I tapped out in the late 2000s. MMA pretty much was all I was watching. And then somebody got me watching NXT when Triple H was running it, and that looked like kind of wrestling, not maybe not necessarily that I grew up on, but pretty close to it. So now that he's taken over creative for these premium live events, he's gone back to a three-hour format, which is perfect. You don't have any more time than that to watch. It's about the length of a football game. So, you know, it's the, and he's got five matches on. So instead of junking the card up, he put matches on that people liked or were interested in. And every one of these matches pretty much told a story. So there were five matches. The first one was Cody Rhodes, who's the Undisputed World Champion, wrestling Kevin Owens. And Kevin Owens didn't really want the match. You know, that's the storyline. But Cody thought he deserved it. And they were friends, and one of the storylines going through that match is, will Kevin Owens turn on Cody like he's turned on so many people in the past? And of course he didn't. And they had a back and forth, interesting wrestling match where they constantly teased whether Kevin Owens was going to turn on Cody or not. And they didn't do too many stupid high spots, which is my only critique of WWE on some of these premium live events. Is they will do some very risky high spots. The only risky high spot in this match was Kevin Owens did a standing senton bomb. So normally the person's laying on the mat and you do a, he will do like a 360 and land with his upper shoulders on the guy's stomach. He did that with a guy on his shoulders, with Cody on his shoulders, and Cody 220. And then Owens is about 260, and he jumped and did that flip in the air and almost didn't get over. And if he hadn't got over, he'd have come down straight on his neck and crippled himself, or straight on his head, broke his neck and crippled himself. So I thought that that was an unnecessary, dangerous high spot, but he did it. But I think his feet slipped on the ropes or something when he went over, because he barely got over.
Right.
So the next match was Bianca Belair and Jade Cargill versus Alba Fyre and Isla Dawn, who beat them at the Scottish. Isla and Alba are both Scottish. Before she was Alba Fyre, she was Kaylee Ray. And I don't know why they insist on changing people's names when they've already been in WWE under a different name, but they won in Scotland. I figured they were going to put the belts back on Bianca and Jade when they were back in the States. They actually waited to this Berlin card. But the match went 12 minutes, which was probably about 4 minutes too much. Jade looks amazing, but she is green as grass. And she needs Bianca. She needs to be in a tag team with Bianca for a while, just so Bianca can teach her and lead her. And I will say that Jade is starting to pick up the working aspect of it, because it doesn't look like her stuff hurts the girls nearly like it used to. She's so strong. she has could just throw these girls around with no problem. But some of the landings some of these girls took were pretty rough. This time, it didn't look like anything hurt them.
Mm.
And then the third match went about 19 minutes. It was a strap match between CM Punk and Drew McIntyre. This, to me, is the most compelling storyline in the whole card. And Drew and CM Punk have been feuding for a couple months now. CM Punk cost Drew the world title after Drew won it at WrestleMania. And then Priest cashed in and took it from Drew right away. Drew had it for like 6 minutes. And so Drew beat CM Punk in their first match. I can't remember if it was, I think it was SummerSlam. Yeah, it was SummerSlam. Drew won that match. And now CM Punk won the strap match. And so now I expect this to go one more match. They'll have a rubber match, and that'll be the blow-off for the feud. But for a strap match, it wasn't too horrible. And in general, I don't like all the gimmick matches, but this one, there was real animosity between the two of them, so it made sense. They just weren't whipping each other with a strap for no reason. They had real animosity about Punk not being able to wrestle for a few months because of McIntyre, and McIntyre being furious because Punk cost him the world title. The fourth match was the one they almost lost me on, and that was the Terror Twins, which is Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley, and they beat the Judgment Day of Dirty Dom, Mysterio, and Liv Morgan, who were considerably smaller. It's almost physically preposterous if Dom wasn't playing the chicken crap heel. It would be physically preposterous, but the way they set it up, it actually works because Dom and Liv are going to bump a lot for Damian and Rhea. But the rest of the Judgment Day, there's three other guys, came down and got involved. And for half a second, I thought they were going to let Dominic and Liv win, which would have just been preposterous, but they didn't. Priest kicked out, and then he and Rhea beat Dom and Liv. And it was a 14-minute match that did what it was supposed to do. That was highlight Damian Priest and Rhea Ripley. And then the last match on the card, because they were in Berlin, so Gunther, who's the new world champion and from Austria, had a match with Randy Orton. And the concept for this match is as old as professional wrestling itself. You take an established former world champion and you have the new champion beat him. That's actually what was going on when Munn had the series of matches with Zbyszko. Zbyszko put him over those first few matches and lulled Sandow and them into thinking that he was just going to go along and wouldn't double-cross Munn. But Zbyszko was a former world champion, so Sandow gets Zbyszko, who he trusts, and that's who he's going to have put over Munn to establish Munn's bona fides as the real world champion. And this is a similar type situation. Like I said, it's old as wrestling itself. You have Randy Orton put Gunther over, and that helps make Gunther as a legitimate world champion and a huge star. And the match went about 34 minutes back and forth. And then at the end of the match, Gunther and Randy Orton shake hands. And that's kind of like the old champ acknowledging and coronating the new champion. So that match did exactly what it was supposed to do. And the concept is as old as wrestling itself. So that was one of the better cards I've seen all year. And WWE hasn't done a bad card yet with that I've seen with Paul Levesque in charge. There's a couple that I was... Like King of the Ring, I wasn't real crazy about, but I wouldn't say any of them were bad. However, let's talk about NXT No Mercy, which was the next night, which I still haven't finished. NXT is the training program for WWE. It doesn't mean the guys in it and girls in it do not have any experience. A lot of them have independent wrestling experience. Some of them have wrestled for Tony. And I was actually interested in the main event because Joe Hendry has a strong reputation and he wrestles with TNA, which is sort of a third promotion. It was big when the Jarretts were running it, and Dixie Carter's family owned it, but it's kind of the distant third now, way behind WWE and AEW. But WWE has a working relationship with TNA, and they're kind of like another feeder system. So Joe Hendry was wrestling Ethan Page, who was in AEW just a few months ago. And I was really interested in that match because both of those guys are better than average. Mm. And, but unfortunately, the first three matches so completely took me out of the show. And the problem with the match, they were, all three of them had the same problem. There was no real story. Or when they finally did get around to the story, it was at the tail end of the match. It was just a bunch of high spots. These guys going out and showing the moves they could do, but they didn't go together. They didn't make any sense. There was obvious cooperation in a lot of them, and it just took me completely out of it. And then the big angle in the first match was Ridge Holland, who is built like a brick outhouse. He is in this match with Andre Chase, and it's Chase University. And they're teasing that they're going to have a falling out, which they do. Well, in every card, every week, whether it's AEW or WWE, somebody goes through a table just about every week. And one of the ways that they make that easier is if they know that they've got a spot in that next match coming up where they're going to try to put somebody through a table, to make it easier to break that table when they do it, they take a couple of the pins out. And when they take a couple of the pins out of that table, it's much easier for them to break the table. Well, they want to do kind of a hospitalization angle with Andre Chase, so they don't take any of the pins out of the table. And he slams Andre Chase on the table, and Andre Chase rolls over onto the floor. And then the referees are calling for the medics, and they bring out a backboard, and they put a neck brace on him. And well, you see guys 100 pounds smaller than both Andre Chase and Ridge Holland going through these tables. So it's absolutely preposterous that this big guy can't put this other big guy through the table unless they've got the table rigged up not to break. And he hits a table, which people do every single week, go through it and get up and go back 5 minutes later and win the match. But he's so injured by bouncing off this table that they have to take him out on a stretcher. And he is supposedly seriously injured. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is just so utterly ridiculous and preposterous that I was so taken out of. That was the first match. And then the next two high spot matches I saw, the two matches at the end of the card were the two I was interested in, and I haven't even gone back to watch it because I was so disgusted by the first three. And I was thinking when I watched this, you know, maybe I'll go back and give NXT a chance. I haven't watched it for a few years now. And no, I don't think so. So as much as it's better under Paul Levesque, it is sure isn't perfect.
Right.
And your uncle should be home for Survivor Series. So the plan is to have you guys watch a few of the matches on Survivor Series with us so you can give your thoughts on it. Because people like your guys' perspective, because you're not wrestling. I was going to say you're not traditional wrestling fans. You're not wrestling fans.
Right.
Eventually, I'd like to get Solomon back on the podcast just because I enjoyed that episode we did.
Nice,
middle of a topic, and all of a sudden, one of the guests says, "Papa, how much longer are you going to be talking?"
Honestly, he's only got so big of a battery.
Was the words you had to edit out because Christina taught Connor a new word, and then while Kale was telling the story, taught Solomon a new word.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, they're like parrots. They'll pick up what you say.
Yes, they are.
Okay, so the Killer Clowns from Outer Space has just popped on the TV. And I'm looking at these supposedly scary guys. They all look like a bunch of guys you would see, you know, 50, 60 years old sitting at a bar somewhere on a Saturday night. I wouldn't be worried about any of these guys coming after me.
Dad, I'm going to be real with you. This movie was not made to be scary. It's made to be goofy, which is why people love it. Anyone who actually finds this movie scary, I think it just might just be done with life, you know? Just roll over at that point, I suppose.
Or like our sister who is terrified of clowns.
Oh, yep. I remember when she first told me that. I was like, Katie, why would you be scared of something that you could step on their shoes? They can't get away from you.
I think for her, it's just the uncanny valley of it. Because, like, for Caleb, when Caleb and I were kids, well, I say Caleb and I, but, like, this is one of my things. I did not like dolls or mannequins or anything like that. But I grew out of it because you just learn, like, oh, hey, I can just football kick that thing out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just something, like, unusual about it.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was scared of dogs, but I got bit by
not dudes. Dogs, dolls.
No, I know what you said. I understood what you said, the mannequin.
He shared his trauma, right?
There are a lot of people that have that mannequin fear.
Yeah, I know.
But I was not afraid of dogs until I got bit by Duke, which was my grandpa's dog. He was a German Shepherd Great Dane mix. And because I trusted him so much, I got bit when I was like 10 or 11. Because he was old. He was 14 years old. He would not have bit me, except he was so old. And I had been tugging on him, because I always used to tug him and take him with me wherever I wanted to go. But he was sick and old. And when I tugged on him, I accidentally hurt him and didn't realize it. And he barely bit me, enough to scare the heck out of me. But as soon as he realized what he did, he let go. And he went over in the corner and lay down and was whimpering. But that so freaked me out, because I trusted him so much. I was scared of dogs, so I was probably in my early mid-20s. Coop used to always say, if there's a 300-pound guy here wanting to fight, he'll push me out of the way to fight him. But if there's a dog, I'm on my own. But then after we got Sultan, then that didn't bother me anymore.
Sultan was a good dog, though.
Yeah. Well, and he was a German Shepherd Lab mix.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't really care for snakes, but I'm not scared of them. I'm been around them all the time out here. I don't think I want to really come across a bear when I'm hiking. I can do without that.
Oh, yeah. Just remember the old rhyme, Dad. If it's black, fight back. If it's brown, get on the ground. If it's white like the president, you finna be heaven sent.
Yeah.
Just remember that, you'll be fine.
Yeah. I did not hear the third phase of that.
the polar bear will kill you.
Yeah, if you see polar bear, it's too late.
The grizzly brown bears can, but a lot of times they won't unless you scare them or, you know, they got mama with babies or stuff. And the black bears are funny because they're normally very cowardly, but that's the only bear that'll do a predatory attack. Yeah. So it's weird. Most of the time they're scared, but.
I mean, I still wouldn't want to run into one.
Yeah, well, I've thought about getting bear spray.
Because
it's $20 a can. That's the only thing they said that's really effective against bears. They've had grizzlies and black bears charging people, and they spray them with that bear spray, and it stops them right in their tracks.
Dang.
Because the gun ain't going to do you any good. The gun will be better for you to turn on yourself than that grizzly.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Chances of you hitting that grizzly with a handgun in an area
that's going to be. Roosevelt shoot a bear and then, like.
With a big rifle.
Heart. Yeah, he hit it in the heart, and with that little death swipe that the bear was already, like, mid-charge on, like, put a massive gash on his arm.
Yeah, he had scars on his arm for the rest of his life from that. He had shot it, and it was charging him, because he got, like, three rounds into it. The third one went into its heart.
Right.
And he stepped aside, and as he stepped aside and that one had gone into his heart, that bear swiped him as he went by in his death throes. The bear was dying. But he swiped him as he was going by and put three big old bear scars on his arm where it caught him.
Right. Yeah, even just while dying still did more damage than most people will ever do in their entire life.
Yep. So that's why I've thought about getting the bear spray when we go on our hike. And I mean, it's cheap. It's like $28 a can, and it's worth having just as
right.
A very rare chance you could run into one there. But they're a lot more prevalent in Missouri than they used to be.
Yeah, Maddie and I were talking about that because, of course, she's got bears in California. I'm like, the bears are the real thing you would have to be concerned about here because we have a lot more woods than you do in California.
Yeah.
Like, you got bears, but we got a lot of them.
Yeah, and we got bears in Jefferson County. People have seen them on their cameras and everything.
Right.
You go out in your backyard and there's one sitting in the koi pond taking a bath. So, well, have you guys got anything else? Because that was all I wanted to cover this week.
No, I think that's it for me. It was nice hearing some good old history and about your new book.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about this project because I think it's going to clear up a lot of myths, particularly about Stecker. One of the things about Stecker, which was true, Stecker had some mental health issues, and they really got on him in the early 30s. So he lost the title to Lewis in 28. And Lewis and Stecker never really saw eye to eye, but there was never like anything that happened between the two of them. They were just competitive rivals. They were the two absolute best wrestlers from the teens into the 20s. And there was this natural rivalry between the two of them of who was the best, and it was Lewis. Lewis beat him in all the legitimate contests, but, you know, Stecker was just a step behind and is a great wrestler. But he had some mental health issues, and I think that they were starting to bother him when he was the world champion that last time, and that's what people were talking about, because after Stecker double-crossed him, he sat in the ring and cried after that happened. That's unusual for a competitive athlete to break down like that, but it seemed like he was struggling then. But then in the early 30s, he was fleeced by some con men who got a lot of his money, and that led him to have a complete nervous breakdown. And he ended up being put in a home, a mental health facility, and he spent 50 years there.
That is terrible.
Yeah, at least 40. He was 80 when he died. He spent at least 40 years in a mental health facility.
What year was this?
So Stecker was the champion in the teens, and then 25 to 28. The teens to 1920, that was his second to last reign. And then the 1925 to 1928, he was world champion again. And then in 31, 32... he was built by those guys. And then he wrestled for like another 2 years, and he was trying to, you know, build back as much money as he could. But in 34, I think it was 34. And that would make sense because he died in 74 at 80 years of age. And he lived in that mental health facility from 34 to 74.
What a terrible time to end up in a mental health facility.
Yep.
Yeah.
His brother, Tony, made sure he was pretty well cared for, thankfully. So, Lou Thesz, in the late 30s, he was friends with Tony Stecker. And Tony said, hey, I've been telling Joe about you. He'd like to meet you. Well, Joe was in the mental health facility.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Thesz, who's a young shooter, you know, he's wrestled work matches, but he knows how to wrestle legitimately. And these three other guys, who all knew how to wrestle, go to the mental health facility to meet him. And Thesz said that Stecker wrestled all four of those guys. Now, Stecker had been in the mental health facility at this point for 4 or 5 years, and he was in his early 40s. Thesz and these other three wrestlers were in their early 20s, and he said Stecker beat all four of them multiple times. None of them could touch him. And here's somebody who'd been in a mental health facility for 4 or 5 years in his early 40s, was not training other than, you know, doing some physical exercise in the facility. And he beat all four of those young wrestlers like they were nothing. Because Dez said how much he admired Stecker and how great Stecker was. He said, you know, Stecker and Lewis were his two heroes.
Right.
Oof. So I'd like to clear up some of the myths and stuff around Stecker. Stecker is somebody I've wanted to research for a while. I'm definitely going to do a book on his early title reign in the teens, because in the early to mid-teens, he was actually better than Lewis. Lewis always wrestled really defensive when he had those first few matches with Stecker, because he knew he was a little behind Stecker at that point. In the late teens, Lewis kind of surpassed him, and then they weren't really equal anymore. Lewis was 1A and Stecker was 1B, and that was pretty much the way they would remain for the rest of their career. But when they first started wrestling each other, Stecker was ahead of Lewis.
Right.
And I have no idea what we're going to do in the next podcast on, so everybody can come back.
I've just been learning about Stecker.
Yeah, we'll definitely have some history topics. If your uncle is on the podcast, we will probably have a pretty lengthy update, because I know he wanted to go over a bunch of the news stories. You know, it'd be an opportunity for him to take the piss out of people, which is one of his favorite things to do in life.
Oh, yeah, sorry for not talking too much. I didn't want to move in my chair.
Yeah.
Look, I'm not a fan of it either, but it's something you live with. All right.
No, we had one of the issues we had. We finally figured out what it was. So with Skype, and I'm surprised we're hearing that, because that new software thing that they did on Skype, you can't hear the fan blowing right by me. All you can hear is what I'm saying into the mic.
I can vaguely, but
it filters out most of the background and everything. But
right.
Well, now I just can't hear him at all.
Yeah, we can't hear you now.
You can't hear me at all.
Okay, there you are. Now you're back. Now you're back.
Oh, sorry about that. Maybe I jostled my microphone.
Oh, you're fine.
But so with Dan, he had one time he had an air mattress. So we were having to cut out all the stuff where you'd hear every time the air mattress would pump would kick on. Then one time he had something else going on. And then we figured out there was like two episodes the audio was really bad. He had us on his phone without a headset on. So we were hearing ourselves every time.
Right.
So it'll be really good when we're back in the $1 million studio, because your uncle has not adapted to the technology real well.
I don't believe he has, no.
But, yeah, you know why Dan wants to do the podcast every week, because all he has to do is sit there and take the piss out of people. I'm the one that actually has to do the research.
Oh, yeah, well, he just gets to sit here and complain about wrestling while you talk about Stecker, I suppose.
Yeah.
Shoot.
I think he's insulted just about every person walking the face of the earth. So.
What a legacy.
Yeah. And people, you know, tune in to hear us do that.
I guess they do.
We were always, you know, we'd get a letter or something from somebody who had listened and liked the show. And I said, you know, when we were 17, 18, 19, most of the people in our family would have given us a couple $100 to shut up.
And now, dang.
Now people listen to us on purpose.
Look, all right, you just got better at it.
We were quite obnoxious when we were younger.
We were kind of terrible.
Yeah, we were.
Dang.
So, all right, well, until next time, and we will review something, we'll update something, and we'll talk about something, or maybe we'll just review something. One of these days, we're going to review that Iron Claw movie, although I'm already telling you, I've seen a couple of clips, and there's a couple of things I'm already like, I don't know that I'm going to, like, one of the hardest parts is I'm looking at some of the people and who they're supposed to be, and I'm looking at how they, and they don't really look anything like the original, but it's kind of hard to look like some of those guys. There were not a lot of people running around looking like Kerry Von Erich or Terry Gordy. Those are not easy people to find somebody to play. So maybe I need to be a little more laid back about that.
Oh, yeah. Don't be a Civil War buff watching a Civil War movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the worst person to watch a history movie with. Like, that didn't happen. They didn't do it like that. Or cop shows, because those are all so completely preposterous.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
All right. Well, until next time, you guys want to say goodbye or?
Oh, yeah. Goodbye.
Bye.
Very goodbye. Nice, sir. We'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.
Oh, shoot.